If I were to ask each of you to recall a particular event from which your life took a significant turn, I am sure that most, if not all of you, could come up with one, maybe more than one. Since I'm the one who has the floor here, that means I get to tell mine. And with a little luck, it'll get us into our topic for the morning. This one goes back about a dozen years. I had been attending a few, emphasis on a few, of the monthly meetings of the committee down in Lowell that puts on the annual Jack Kerouac Festival there. I was still at that point trying to decide if it was something I really wanted to become strongly involved in or not. I had an interest in the writer at some earlier point in my life and his whole Beat Generation literary genre, but by the early 1990s, my interest in that had kind of waned. I know that admission may come as a surprise to those of you who know me in more recent years and may well have the impression that the first two words out of my infant mouth were Jack Kerouac. I wasn't always this way. I actually used to be normal. You know. Well, as the time for this festival approached, I believe it was in the fall of 1993, I got a call from one of the committee members. Would I chair a panel discussion during the weekend on Kerouac and spirituality? Well, I've been a no-show, as I said, at most of the planning meetings in the month prior, and I was surprised to be asked, but I thought, well, maybe they figured what with me being a minister, all I was supposed to know something about the subject, spirituality, that is, so I figured, okay, why not? I agreed to do it. It wasn't until about a week or so later, though, that I thought to ask somebody who all would be on the panel. Turned out it was a couple of local folk, plus a man named Robert Creeley, who had been a figure in what is still called the San Francisco Poetry Renaissance in the mid-1950s. And oh yeah, Allen Ginsberg. Well, wait here. I am supposed to lead a discussion with Creeley and Ginsberg. Now, I'd always wanted to meet these guys, but to hold my own in a conversation with them in front of what we knew would be a large crowd of people was another matter altogether. Rather than admit that I didn't feel up to the task, I said, hey, that's great, sure, okay. So the day arrives, the room that we're using for this thing, I mean, is completely packed, and I had deliberately dressed down for the occasion, so naturally, Ginsberg shows up clean-shaven and wearing a suit and tie, playing against type of the hairy wild man poet image he tried to cultivate some years earlier. And he sits next to me. Mr. Creeley is at the end of the table. Feeling a bit overwhelmed already, I look up and I see sitting on the front row one of Kerouac's principal biographers and a woman who is generally regarded as one of the better informed historians of that whole era. And she's got her little notepad and pencil all poised there. I look a few more rows back and I see another woman who I recognize as being one of Mr. Kerouac's girlfriends from around the same time in his life that we were going to be discussing. I don't know if you've ever had one of those classic, dear Lord, what am I doing here moments, but that was certainly what this one was. And by now I'm already thinking, you know, is there a back door I can just kind of slip out of here before somebody realizes that I'm an imposter? I decided to go for a little reassurance, so I looked out at my prepared notes that I have that's supposed to launch this discussion, and all I can think then is, boy, this is one load of bull. You can't say this out loud. And it kind of goes on like this. It's about that time that I gave myself a metaphorical slap in my face and ordered myself to snap out of it and summoned up a bit of wisdom that I have long carried around, which was just get this thing underway and fake it till you make it. Really, I figured, okay, I don't quite know what I'm doing here, but I'm going to act like I do and see what happens. I'm not going to die. They can't dock my pay because I'm not getting paid for this anyway, so off it went. And somewhere along the way, my feeling of faking it got tamped down enough, at least where I actually began to enjoy kind of mixing it up with these guys, but I didn't have a good sense of how the whole event had really gone until about a week or so later when the planning committee got back together for our kind of post-festival evaluation meeting, and as that conversation went forward, a lot of it was about how well the panel discussion symposium had gone, and I kept getting thanked for doing this, that, and the other to the point that I began to think, well, maybe I didn't make a complete fool out of myself here after all. And now I got to thinking, maybe I've even got a future with this whole Kerouac beat business, and many of you know kind of where it went from there. So when my dwelling on this subject starts to get a little old, as I'm sure it does now and then, you can blame it on Ginsberg. He probably won't mind, since he's not been with us for about the past 8 years now. But anyway, fake it till you make it was the stance or the attitude that really did get me through that experience that I just described. And the result was that it opened up a part of myself that I scarcely knew I was there, and that I've been cultivating ever since. And I'm going to guess that each one of you probably has your own version of this story as well. I even had some hesitation, speaking of self-doubt, which I never quickly conquered, about going with the sermon title that I'm using for today. Because at first glance or hearing it, it sounds like, or could sound like, I'm endorsing phoniness or fakery. But not really. Not at all. I use this expression instead, and it's gotten me out of quite a few tight spots like the one I just talked about. I've used this expression instead to describe a circumstance where you don't quite know what you're doing, but you still have to act anyway. Or where you don't know with absolute certainty that the stand that you are taking is the right one, but you still have to take a stand. So it's really not about being phony or inauthentic. It's really about trusting yourself when you're in the midst of uncertain or difficult circumstances, or you're trying to get your bearings. It's really about cultivating a capacity for self-trust. It's about living by faith. And there's that word again, which I introduced last Sunday, noting it will be my topic then on this Sunday and next Sunday as well. I'm going to keep it, as you can probably tell, mostly on the personal level today as to what I think it means to be a person of faith in one's personal life. Next Sunday, I'm going to take up the subject of what I believe it means for us to be a liberal religious community of faith in the social and cultural, religious, spiritual, and political climate in which we now find ourselves in these early months of 2005. That's going to be my run-up to the pledge drive, which will happen kicked off the next Sunday, but you're going to have to come back next Sunday to get my angle on that. To return then to the topic for today, as I thought back on that symposium panel discussion experience, I also remembered something I had read some years earlier in a book with the title, And a Voice to Sing With. The book is the autobiography of Joan Baez. Now, a grammatical purist, of course, would say the title should be And a Voice with Which to Sing. But if you're Joan Baez, I guess you can call your book whatever you want, and she did. Now, somewhere in this book, Ms. Baez tells of occasionally having feelings before a concert similar to the ones, very similar to the ones, that I described as having just before this symposium. Self-doubt, inadequacy, what do I think I'm doing here kinds of feelings. And I read this part of her book and was rather surprised, if not amazed, to read that. She's got one of the most clear and beautiful singing voices I think I've ever heard. It's dropped a register or two as she's gotten older, but it's still very beautiful. And Joan Baez, in describing these kinds of feelings she has before concerts, she says that her mantra in such situations is to say to herself, well, put it in the hands of God. Pick up her guitar, walk out, do her thing. Well, reading that got me to thinking, here's the theological part. When I say fake it till you make it, and Joan Baez says put it in the hands of God, are we each in our own way saying the same thing? I can't say for sure, of course. I did have the pleasure of very briefly meeting this woman once, many, many years ago, but we didn't talk about God. I was 23 years old at the time, and while we were conversing, I was saying to myself over and over, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. But at least I didn't blurt it out. Put it in the hands of God. Fake it till you make it. Different language for the same sentiment. It could be that they are both an essential statement of faith, depending on what you take faith to be. And to get at this a little further, I have to loop back for a minute and pick up a thread that I put out in last Sunday's sermon. Those of you who were here may remember that I suggested what I called two modes of faith. I admitted I was drawing overly arbitrary lines and setting them forth, but felt the distinction worked well enough for the sake of the point I was trying to make anyway. Let me go back and pick up on that for just a minute or two. Mode one, as I called it, is a faith that is ultimately vested or anchored in the realm of the supernatural or in whatever a person believes is above and beyond the workings of the natural world. This mode of faith usually involves or contains a willful, intentional, supreme being who is ultimately in charge and who gives one's life meaning, purpose, and direction. And in the absence of such a supreme being, life is devoid of any ultimate meaning in a mode one faith of, in a mode one mind of faith. Mode two faith, staying with the terminology I suggested, is vested in the realm of the natural world and universe. I say that acknowledging that there's a lot we still don't know about what all is in this realm of the natural world and universe. But to be a person of faith in this mode means that you trust in the human capacity for reason and in the strength of the human will and the human spirit, while at the same time seeking something more beyond that. And for me, as a mode two guy, that something more is contained within the realm of the natural. It is that depth dimension to life that I call sacred or holy, and that can be touched and experienced. Now, persons in both of these faith modes, as I'm calling them, can, sometimes do, speak of God. But they are speaking of differing realities or perceived realities. In mode one, as just noted, God is a supreme being who exists outside of the natural realm and who rules over it and over our lives as we live in this world. In mode two, God, when the term is even invoked, is more likely seen as what Emerson and others called one's divine spark, or the God or goddess within, or the blessed spirit of life, who also connects us and our lives to all that is beyond us, and who, in so doing, strengthens and nurtures our own internal resources and barriers. So I was in mode two mode, back at that panel discussion, when I figured I just got to let it go and let it happen and decide that by faith I'd still be on my feet when it was done. Fake it till you make it, believing that you will indeed make it. I don't know for sure that Joan Baez is what I'm calling a mode two person of faith, but if she is, then her own phrase for it, put it in the hands of God, isn't really all that different from my own. Take this matter in another direction for just a few minutes now. Living a life of faith, as I have tried to present it here, which is living with a basically trustful attitude towards life and with one's ability to meaningfully encounter and deal with it, that doesn't shield you from doubt or betrayal or from letting yourself down or letting others down or being let down yourself, sometimes in pretty devastating ways. Faith, I'm trying to say, is not to be confused with certainty, although it oftentimes is. More often than not, when someone says they've lost their faith, what they mean is that they no longer feel certain about something or someone in which they have previously vested absolute certainty. Persons, for example, who believed in a God who would never allow over 175,000 people or whatever that horrible count is up to now to be killed with an unbelievably huge swat from an unbelievably huge ocean wave, now have to believe that such a thing can happen, supreme being or no supreme being. What this event, what this horrific human disaster, like I call it a human disaster, says about how we see ourselves as creatures of nature on the one hand, but also creatures who are supposed to be able to supersede the workings of nature on the other. That's a sermon all by itself that I'm going to take a crack at a little later this spring. The only point I'm trying to make here is that we all live, consciously or not, with a set of assumptions about how the world's supposed to work and how we are supposed to be in it. This, too, I call living by faith. But the world in which we live and the lives we live as a part of it are ultimately not bound by our assumptions or our needs or our desires, as necessary as those assumptions, needs, and desires are to us. I guess what I'm trying to say, without opening too terribly esoteric about it, is that being a person of faith, particularly in this mode two manner that I've suggested, means being willing and able to live in a zone between what you know, trust, and believe in, both about yourself and your world, and those times when you know that what you trust and believe in will still leave you coming up short, sometimes painfully short. It means living in the zone between what you know, trust, and believe in, and what is unknown, unknowable, or mysterious, sometimes painful, sometimes devastatingly mysterious. Faking until you make it doesn't always mean you're going to make it. It just means believing that you can. It also means that when you don't make it, there's still, for you, more life to go, for as long as you have breath, that is. And that gets me to my last point. Living a life of faith means embracing life as fully as you can, and as if it is fully yours, even though in the long run, of course, it's not. I got a blast from a past email this past week from someone who had tracked me down through the church's website. It's like the whole web thing is an amazing thing. I now hear from somebody that's been completely gone out of my life that I thought I was, you know, gone, and they'll do like a little Google search on me and the church's website will come up. The next thing I know, I'm getting this blast from the past. This one, though, was a person who had been a part of a very close circle of friends of mine I had back in the mid-1970s. For the three short but very intense years that I lived in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. We all pretty much lost track of one another over the years since we went our ways, but somewhere in the back of my mind, another one of those life assumptions I was living by, I figured some way or another we would reconnect somehow, some way, sometime. Well, the woman who found me through cyberspace was writing to tell me that one of those in that Stevens Point circle had died at age 65 following a sudden onset of cancer. His name was Jim. I first knew him as one of my campus ministry colleagues. He was this radical Lutheran who got assigned to the campus ministry, I guess, because he was just too far out there for even the most liberal of Lutheran congregations. That's pretty much the same reason I was there as an American Baptist, actually, to tell you the truth. And Jim was a very important person in my life for that short stretch of time, as I believe I was in his. For during our time together, he left the ministry, saw his marriage come to an end, began a relationship with a woman who was also a part of this crowd, and whom, as I learned last week, he married and remained married to for the rest of his life. I, too, left the ministry at the end of those 3 years with respect to the denomination in which I had been ordained. I later came back to the ministry as a Unitarian Universalist. Jim became a university professor. We each saw the other through our respective crises of faith, as it were, and then we went our ways. As I said, I figured we'd catch up to each other again at some point in our lives, and we would share the paths we'd each taken since our paths had taken their ways. And I figured wrong. We didn't make it. It happens. I learned a lot from Jim 30 years ago, and I learned something from him again last week. wasn't something I learned for the first time. He just kind of gave me a little reminder. Life happens. And it happens quicker than you know or expect. To live it by faith means living your life believing you can find meaning in it, that you can find people you can meaningfully and lovingly share it with, and that you can make some kind of positive difference, however great or small, before you have to give it up. That is living a life of faith. And I think, to extend from that a little, that's one of the reasons we're here. So we can offer and be such a faith community. We each bring our lives here in the faith and in the hope that they will in some way be transformed. We each bring our lives here in the faith and in the hope that they can find uplift and restoration and healing at those times when they need it. And we bring our lives here in order that we may place them in the hands of something greater than ourselves. We don't all call that something greater by the same name. And that's fine. That's as it should be because we're a free faith community. But I feel safe in saying we sense the reality of this something greater amongst us as an expression of our collective and common life here. And one that we want to keep going and offer to those who come after us. We come here not always knowing for sure if we're going to make it when it comes to the challenges and the sometimes obstacles that we each face at times. But we come here in order to find the strength to allow us to act as if we can meet those challenges. More often than not, we will. We come in order that our yes to life may be ours to say for as long as we're given our time to say it. And so then, may the presence of the blessed Spirit of life be ours to have and for ours to share. As we continue to grow this community of faith and grow our lives within it, let's sing together our closing hymn. Number 86.